Blog Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand, walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I am just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be strong.
Well, good evening and welcome to Yada Yada Radio. I'm hoping that I am broadcasting now. I can see the switchboard is open. We have JB and Kirk here. How are you guys?
Good evening. Good.
Doing good?
Good, good. Boy, thank you for opening things up for me. I had sent you guys a text or an email early in the day saying it was going to be a long and busy day. I flew from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, to have a late lunch with my son in Bloomington, Indiana, today. And then after that, for a long visit, and then flew back into Cincinnati, landed about, oh, maybe 35 minutes ago, managed to get from the airport up to my apartment here in Cincinnati. We'll be visiting with my grandson and granddaughter and eldest son and his wife the next couple of days. And I am delighted that I printed out the chapter we're going to be discussing because this computer doesn't have Word on it anymore. But I was able to get things up and working. Delighted to be here.
We're educated.
Yeah, so sometimes the timing works out just perfectly. This was just barely snuck under the radar. So we have been jumping way ahead, of course, in Yada Yada, in the book of observations for our time. We had, as everybody knows, we had recently completed Volume 1, and made our way through the first chapter of Volume 2, and we decided to jump ahead to the second, the last chapter of Volume 2, which is prophetic of the last days, of exactly what we should expect with the demise of Damascus, the fall of the Syrian government. The Damascus turned into a heap of ruins. As a result of that, the world forcing Israel to give up what's called the West Bank, Judea and Samaria. And how that's going to parlay into the same conclusion that Neville Chamberlain achieved when he gave up the land he didn't own, the high ground of Czechoslovakia, to Nazis. That's what's going to happen when is surrendered to the Muslims. They're going to attack and they're going to flood into Israel in great numbers. And in so doing, they're going to begin what's called the Magog War. It's a war that is so horrendous in this first phase. It's not a world war in the first phase. It's all the Muslims in the world against Israel, that God himself is going to have to intervene to save Israel from extinction. And what we learn is just right before all that happens, just before this horrendous time of Jacob's troubles, Yahweh is going to comfort his family. And so we're going to experience the fulfillment of the Tarula harvest, which, you know, could be as early as the is Tarula in 2026, 2027, I think, is highly probable as well. Could even be in 2028. But that'll be the Tarula harvest. And the longer we stay, I think, the better, the more opportunity we have to reach people during that phase.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I finished this chapter about a week ago. And it got to be like 147 pages. We took some of the supporting documents, some of the supporting translations out of it. There's a translation of a Mizmor that'll blow your mind about the last days. And then the Song of the Sea, which is one of the most interesting things I've ever translated from the Torah. And they've been put into the next chapter, which, boy, it's amazing how much we can grow over time. Mm-hmm. About 6 or 7 years, I did the translations of Yeshaya 18, which I had come to the conclusion was United States of America. And there were so many indications that seemed irrefutable. And, you know, this whole process of coming up with a procedure of not just studying what the Masoretic vowel pointing would indicate as the word, but mm-hmm. every possible word using the same letters, you know, in the 2,500 years that these prophetic texts and subcases existed prior to the Masoretic vowel pointing. And as I'm doing that this time, I'm almost shell-shocked. It's just so amazing how much more information can be gleaned and how much more convincing the case is that the woe is directed to the United States of America. So, well, we're going to have some fun, I think, when we get into Yeshaya 18. So, my recollection, fellas, and based upon turning the text red, is that we were talking about Yeshaya 17:11. Is that where you'd like to pick up, or you guys either of you have anything you'd like to add?
Either before? That or 12, so that's good.
Okay.
Yeah, 11's a good place to start.
Okay. It says, in the daytime there will be a terminal illness and hopeless infirmity, weakness, affliction, and tribulation, including the influence of incurable and mortal grief and mental anguish. You know, there's never been a time since the expulsion from the garden when there has been a terminal mortality, where there's been total hopelessness, where there's been an incurable situation in terms of humankind, where the only option is anguish and grief. It has done a lot of really rotten things. The history of civilization is the history of human abuse, of war and torture and enslavement of people, and the rule of cleric and king. It's a horrid story, you know, mm-hmm. the story of man. But even though very few people availed themselves of the Torah's restoring attributes and this path that Yahweh has provided, when I read this, what I see is that there is no longer a middle ground, that popular fate of souls where they simply cease to exist. At this point, you're either going to rid yourself of the disease via the only method possible, which is a celebration of Pesach, Matzah, Bikurim, Shavuot. So you're going to accept the terms and conditions of the covenant. You're going to answer Yahweh's invitation to meet with him. You are going to rid your soul of this terminal disease by disassociating from religion and politics, from militarism. You're going to accept the five terms and conditions of the covenant. Or your situation is irresolvable. You think that's too harsh a interpretation, that middle ground where the victims of religion, the victims of politics, those who have been misled. Their soul simply ceased to exist. Those who never promoted lies that took people away from Yahweh, religiously, politically, militarily, but who didn't come to know him either. And you know, they're, at the end of their lives, there's no punishment, there's no penalty. Their soul simply ceased to exist. Am I reading too much into this to suggest
no,
that
they have to bow down to the Torah? Well, they have to bow down to the Torahless one at that point. I mean, there's very little food to eat. Everything is controlled. He'll pretty much put them in subjugation, and they will. And I think they'll fall in love with the guy, like they do with Paul and like they do with Muhammad, the people that left. So not a chance. That you'd be wrong on.
I think
that's exactly how I said that.
But to imagine a period like that, and you added an element to it, Kirk, that it's certainly part of this whole mindset is that upon the arrival of the Torahless One, he's going to do a lot of things that those who do not know Yahweh are going to love. You know, that we're going to be in an economic period where the currency is debased to the point where it essentially has no value. And if it has no value, then debt has no value. And so what the Torahless One's going to do to garner support is going to say to all those people who, and the average American, let's just put it in the perspective of those here in America, and my guess is it's similar in Europe and the South Pacific and the like. The average American has about $500,000 in debt, anywhere from $250 to $500,000 in debt. And that debt is auto loans, credit card outstanding balances, and a home mortgage. And collectively, the average American is about anywhere from $250 to $500,000 in debt. And the average American, their total savings is under $1,000. So they've got nothing in savings, and they have all this debt. So somebody were to come along and say, your debt is forgiven. All you have to do is sign up for my monetary plan. And my monetary plan says, all debts are forgiven. Money currency is not worth anything anyways, so what does it care? And you just go to an entirely electronically-based currency. And people aren't going to have any problem if he's going to present the electronic-based currency as, look at the convenience of this. You no longer have to carry around that cash that doesn't have any value anyway, and we can stamp out all of the bad influences so that your government can protect you from terror and from oppression and all of these things, and drug dealers by having insights into how money is spent. And, you know, so long as the government doesn't think you're a threat, you can buy and sell. Your debts are forgiven. They think you are a threat. You'll have no means whatsoever to buy food, to pay for shelter. Your credit will be nil. So when he says that kind of stuff and then tells everybody that, you know, they're the best and that the great times are ahead and look what we're doing economically, and then motivates them to go off for some crazy battle, they're going to rally around them. Mm-hmm. And the deal has always been that if you're promoting and allied with the adversary, then you're going to spend your eternity with him. And so that could well be the issue, is that there is no middle ground anymore because everyone on the planet has taken sides. Very few have sided with Yahweh, and the vast preponderance have sided with Halal bin Shakar, Satan, the adversary. And the moment they side with him, they've precluded themselves the annihilation of their souls. But I think that's what this is. I think this is a warning that if you have the disease of religion, or politics, or militarism, you're done. It's incurable. There's no, you know, Kirk, J.B., you weren't so much in this camp, but both Kirk and I were Christian and religious.
Mm-hmm.
And as such, the fact of the matter is that if we were in this period, we'd be in a bad way. Now, we were religious. We weren't knowingly siding with HaSatan, but we were certainly on the wrong side of this equation. But we were on it at a time where we still had time to walk away from and disengage from religion and accept the terms and conditions of the covenant.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't seem to me that that's going to be possible going forward. And the only thing that strikes me as, well, how does this play out for the Yehudim, the Israelites, that are going to be reconciled in the relationship? And perhaps the answer to that is that the Torahless one, like Rome, you know, like when Constantine legalized all religions,
mm-hmm.
he legalized all but one.
Yeah.
Judaism.
Yeah.
And anything to do with the Torah was still prohibited. All religions accepted the Torah was prohibited. And I think in Rome being the ultimate beast, what we're going to see is something very similar. So perhaps the reason that Israel is not caught up in the incurable nature of this is they will not be caught up on the wrong side, because even though there may be a number of years prior to the reconciliation, they will be expressly prohibited from being part of the Torahless ones' economic and religious and political order.
Yeah.
Well, much like Jews weren't allowed to join the Nazi party. You know, Israel mm-hmm. as a whole will be forbidden from participation.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's true. And I think that's one of the reasons why Jews en masse, you know, Yahweh talks about bringing Israel home.
Mm-hmm.
Collecting it for the four corners of the earth. And one of the reasons that that's going to be possible is that it will become impossible to live as a Jew outside of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Israel will be the only country on earth that a Jew will be able to pay for and have food and shelter.
You know, they would still be celebrating the Shabbat, and they would still be circumcising their children. So they're going to be isolated. But I think Yahweh must be, you know, putting something around and protect them until his until the next phase comes. I mean,
well, to some degree, they're going to be the Magog.
Yeah, they're going to annihilate a lot of them. But I mean, you've got to protect the core group.
Probably two thirds. Probably 2/3. But I think that is the answer is that last harvest, this Teruah harvest, is probably going to have more Goyim than Yehudim.
Mm-hmm.
But that last harvest is going to be almost exclusively Yehudim, because they will be excluded from participating in Halalba and Shakar's schemes and the Torahless One schemes, and as such, living in Israel and apart from his schemes, they won't have allied themselves with him, and therefore will still be in that situation where they can choose. And at the end, they will make that choice.
Dictators often rise to power, you know, with the use of a scapegoat. And
correct.
That's what they'll be. They'll be the scapegoat.
Yeah.
You know, you already hear enough of it from the anti-Semitic people about how Jews control all the wealth of the world. They control all the businesses.
Right.
It's the same rhetoric that'll be taunted then, and that's why they'll be excluded from the system.
Right. Yeah, today I was sitting there flying my airplane, and of course there were chemtrails all about. And I I kept asking my co-pilot about the chemtrails. I said, so if those are really chemtrails, why do they just look like water vapor and everything else that's like these clouds that we're looking at? Why do they look indistinguishable from clouds if they're chemtrails and not water vapor? Or if they really were chemtrails and the government was smart enough to poison people via this this method, why did they make them so visible? Why not just make it like carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and invisible? Or can you explain to me, since they all, these chemtrails all occur at 32,000 feet and 34,000 feet, how do they ever affect people on the ground? Where they allegedly they fall. Now, so, you know, I've seen chemtrails from all sides now, from up and down and near and far. And you know, guess what? No contrail has ever fallen. They're in a strata where they just dissipate. They're in a strata where they can exist, and they ultimately dissipate when the temperatures and the amount of humidity changes, the dew point changes in that strata. Just go. But the reason I mentioned that is because all of the conspiracy theories are moronic. It's just like I was talking about driving by a Mormon church, and you say, you know, the Book of Mormon is among the dumbest books ever written. Now, the Quran may be the dumbest book ever written. It's just astonishing that you could have so many people fooled by something that's so obviously false. And so I don't think that the Torahless one is going to find it difficult between conspiracy theories, you know, and what has been the longest and most overwhelmingly destructive conspiracy theory of all time. That, you know, Jews are manipulating the world. The conspiracy of the, you know, the elders of protocols of the elders of Zion. Mm-hmm. You know, they control the banking. They control the media. They control, you know, everything. And it's not, in fact, it's not true.
No.
So,
you know that the Greeks, when they conquered, taken over that section of Egypt, they rewrote the history. The Ptolemies rewrote the history, and they assigned the history of the Amalekites to the Jews. Yeah, they did. And it was like, because everybody hated the Amalekites, so they just decided that's who they were. They were the ones who came down and invaded. I mean, all you got to do is rewrite history, and most people just follow along. They obviously never read Torah or any type of history. So.
Well, here in America, just think about how the history has been rewritten to create this concept of manifest destiny. When, JP, you're in a state that was literally stolen.
Oh, yeah.
In fact, Kirk, you're in a state that was stolen.
Yeah.
It was stolen.
Yeah, I remember in college, I first learned the real history of Texas. Like, I grew up hearing the stories of, you know, these people came down and they fought for their freedom from Mexico. And I was in a history class at college that was taught by a man who grew up in Mexico. He's like, this is what happened. It's like, they were down here for 5 years, claimed homestead, and then claimed that they were being oppressed and decided to kick the Mexicans out. They asked to come. They bought land.
Right.
And then they just said, oh, well, this is ours now.
Yeah, right.
You know,
You know, Alabama did the same thing. They killed all the Indians and sent them off to, and tried to kill the rest of them, going off to the Trail of Tears, going to Oklahoma.
Tears.
Because the cotton was so good that the people in Georgia said, you know, we need this land.
Yes.
That's what.
You know, I live now in the state of Florida, and you know what?
Seminole down
there.
They had
the Seminole
British, and then they killed them.
Right.
God.
So, anyway, it's going to be extraordinarily easy for the Torahless one to fool the vast preponderance of people. Today, people are fooled by Trump on one side. You know, I read this morning that Elizabeth Warren, the woman, the senator that's going to run again for the Democratic side, and she may be the lead candidate, although Bernie, my least favorite communist, is running again. And first, the thing she came out with today is reparations for African Americans. Reparations. Now, the last person that was enslaved in the 1860s.
Yeah, I'm
being reparations then? I'm all for. But reparations now? I'm going to tell you for certain. There isn't a single slave alive today. And what, what is, you know, if reparations were appropriate for such a thing, how long would they, you know, but it was a little over 100 years that people were enslaved in America, bad institution. A lot of Americans died too because of that institution, terrible thing. But how long were Jews enslaved in Egypt?
400 years.
Yeah, you're saying to the Egyptian government, yeah, that you need to pay reparations?
Hardly.
Now, the, with the diaspora, with Hadrian's export of Jews into to Rome and throughout Europe, they were enslaved for, hundreds of years.
Hundreds and hundreds
of reparations. It's just so easy to get people to support you. If you tell them, you know, you're owed, you deserve this, that, and the other thing. No, there's one. Not going to be her money. Yeah, by the way, I think we've had reparations called welfare.
What?
It's not her money? So,
yeah, the idea that people that never owned slaves should pay money to people who were never slaves. I don't get it.
Right. I don't get it. The whole thing is just so mesmerizingly stupid to me. But that is the era we're in. Very few people can think. There's no sense of reason. And on top of all that, you have a injustice system in America that no one in their right mind should trust. Not the cops, not the judges, not the Department of Justice, not the FBI, none of them. And so the whole thing's a house of cards and a sham at this point. But I think that Kirk, your comment is correct. The reason that we're going to reach a time, terminal disease and hopeless infirmity, a time of affliction and tribulation where mortality is incurable, is because they're not just going to accept the Torahless One's plan. They're going to love him.
They're all in. Yeah.
Yeah, they're going to be all in. He is going to be their Lord God. He is going to be their Savior. They're going to buy his program and completely. This is a yom of Shalah, of terminal disease, an incurable infirmity, of weakness and affliction, even tribulation. Shalah is wounds which are inflicted, which are irredeemable, causing all of those who suffer from them to inherit eternal ka'eb, grief, anguish, and sorrow. So, this is not the death of the soul, this is you're inheriting, literally inheriting, eternal anguish. It is a time of anush, of incurable woe and incapacitating and irrecoverable self-inflicted wounds which are unhealable. So, I'm always cautious when we're dealing with something that is so startling and so different than the norm, of saying, this is my interpretation of this, but boy, I'm really open to someone seeing it a different way.
By definition, incurable is ongoing. And
yes.
So death will cure that. I mean, it may not be the cure you want, but it ends the suffering, and this is not saying it's ending the suffering. It's tenuous grief and mental anguish.
Right. And we have to. Time matters with Yahweh. There is a schedule. And we're approaching the end of a phase. And this is a major terminus. It's probably the single biggest terminal point since Adam and Chawa started the time clock on man's schedule with God nearly 6,000 years ago. So it is a time where through your 6,000 Yah, as we pass through years 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5,000 Yah. This is a time where year 6,000 Yah and 6,001 as we begin the march to 7,000. We begin that 1,000 Yah year celebration of Sukkah and the Sabbat. That is a return to Eden. And so there has to be a timeline drawn there that says, past this point, you cannot progress if you're religious. You can't even share the planet with us. Can't share the planet if you're patriotic or if you're political. So, it is the one time and the one and only time where there is a time stamp on life here on Earth, where it is you can't go beyond this point if you're religious, and it'll be the first time that ever happens. But it makes perfect sense, just as there was a wall around Eden, keeping those who were political and religious and militaristic out. There's a timeline here that's going to keep those who are political and religious and deadly and menacing out. And the only way to do that is to say, if you've got religion at this point, if you're allied with the adversary,
Torahless one,
yeah, it's over. You're out. You know, it's like,
not fair.
Once we, I think it is fair. And it, you know, there's another thing that changes, and God is very explicit, telling us there's something remarkable that's going to change when the covenant is renewed upon His return.
Of course, yeah.
And it's something that, we can't even fathom how different that is than where we are right now. You read those terms, and then Yahweh is literally going to write a copy of this Torah inside of us and write His name on our hearts, our sense of faith. Now, that is beyond anything we can even... That's like, Kirk, I want you to draw me a picture of the fifth and sixth dimensions. In my view, that is difficult for me to fathom. Because the Torah He's writing inside of us is going to be so enlightening, so empowering, so enriching, so liberating, and so unlike anything we've ever seen. And you might say, wait a minute, how could it be on the Torah, and how could it be unlike anything we've ever seen? Because the Torah He's writing in us is His direction and His teaching for how to live.
What comes next?
Right. In the millennial Sukkah and in the
way beyond
new universe, right, through eternity, there beyond. And so then the Torah now, and particularly as the Torah continues through the Psalms and the Prophets, so much of it is devoted to say, don't be religious when you're... You're religious, this is the consequence. Don't be political. When you're political, this is the consequence. If you don't listen to what I have to say, this is the consequence. You know, it makes me really angry. There's no need for any of that. Like, it's all going to be counterproductive. So it's all going to be uplifting, empowering, enriching, enhancing directions, guidance, and teaching. So that we collectively get the most enjoyment out of eternity. So we know that God says specifically that the renewal of the covenant isn't going to be the same as it was with Abraham. Because with Abraham, the Torah was still external. Which means that everyone, including Yitzhak's two sons, Jacob and Esau, they were put in a position they could choose to embrace it, reject it.
Mm-hmm.
And that has always been the case. You know, the religion of Christianity, the religion of Islam, the religion of Rabbinic Judaism, none of those religions exist with the integration of the Torah. They all require the rejection of the Torah. That's an odd rejection, of course, because the Rabbinic Talmud claims that it is arguments on the Torah and was given at the same time, so that's an odd duck. And, of course, the Quran claims erroneously that it confirms the Torah, and Christians carry the Torah around in their Bible, not recognizing that it destroys every aspect of the religion. You know, this is where we're headed, and it's a very, very different experience. Now, as it relates to this tribulation, and tribulation is a term that I don't use very much anymore because it's just too Christianized. Yeah, Christianized. But in Yirmiyah 37, which is the where it explains the time of Jacob's troubles. The word for troubles is depicted with sar, T-S, and then a rosh, sar. Now, it speaks of the idea that Yah's chosen are going to be narrowed and confined and in dire straits. Isn't that interesting that the word for time of Jacob's troubles echoes the thing that's going to set off the flooding in of Islamic terrorists into Israel? The thinning of the country at the waist? Well, sar itself means to narrow and to confine and to put people in dire straits. So Jacob's trouble is defined by this knowing of Israel at the waist, the very thing that we've been reading about in Yeshayah 17. So there's a heck of a clue as to what defines the time of Jacob's troubles. Then the country at the waist, 5 to 7 miles wide, where 70% of the people live, with a billion people on either side wanting to destroy that country, and the rest of the world being against them. Goodness. So narrowed and confined in dire straits, greatly distressed by the adversary and oppressed by enemy forces, caged in and besieged, vexed and harassed, feeling the sharp edge of the flint as a heated reaction is kindled and a sharp knife is used to cut and kill. So if you fully amplify the meaning of sar, narrowed and confined in dire straits, greatly distressed by the adversary and oppressed by enemy forces, caged in and besieged, vexed and harassed, feeling the sharp edge of the flint as a heated reaction is kindled and a sharp knife is used to cut and kill. The time of Jacob's tsar. While Yisrael's, and Jacob is Yisrael's tsar, will be short-lived, the adversary and those who are with him will be tsar, besieged and confined, caged in, shut up, and oppressed in a hostile, vexing, and diminutive place forever in Sheol. It's one of the reasons I happen to like a lot of reasons I like this term and feel so much more comfortable with the time of Jacob's tsar's troubles is because it defines what's going to happen to Yisrael, and it defines what's going to be the consequence that's going to haunt for all eternity those who try to destroy Yisrael. It's the full story, in a word, vastly superior to tribulation. Now, the next prophetic statement alerts us to the impending peril of what I think is the Magog War. And I think that the Magog War is essentially two phases. I don't have any absolute proof of this, but the more you kind of read these prophetic statements, the more it seems like the first phase of the Magog War is after the Syrian government has fallen, after Damascus is a heap of ruins, after the United States and Europe force Israel to give up the West Bank, and she's thinned and becomes vulnerable in dire straits. After the Truro harvest, Muslims, by what could be 100 million, could be 150 million Muslims, are going to flood into Israel. And that begins the time of Jacob's trouble. That is not a world war. But the world is going to get involved in this war because everyone seems to have a vested interest. The United States and Europe on one side, China and Russia on the other. And we're seeing now China and Russia teaming together on almost everything in opposition to the United States and Europe. The handwriting's on the wall on all of this. And, of course, in Syria, which is the impetus for all of this, the United States and Europe and Russia and China are on loggerheads with each other. And you've got Turkey on one side and Saudi Arabia on another.
Mm-hmm.
You've got Shiites and Sunnis. The Kurds, 40 million people. I mean, oh my goodness. I mean, it is inevitable that this is going to happen. And I do think that the second phase of that make-up war is catastrophic. I think it's going to be a nuclear holocaust. I think that we don't know the triggering event. I strongly disagree with the idea that Israel is going to be nuked by Iran. Iran could nuke Damascus when Damascus falls to Sunni Muslims. And when the Muslims go out in such desperate fashion, it's easy to see how the United States and Russia will go after each other.
Putin almost said that today. Well, the other day.
What did Putin say today?
I'm trying to recall. I'm sorry, but he said, something to the effect, I'm paraphrasing terribly, but he said basically he was rattling his saber back at Trump and saying, if you want to have this type of thing like a Cuban crisis with the United States, I'm all prepared. I mean, another showdown, and I'm going, wow, man, that's... You're equating what you want to do with the Cuban crisis. That was bringing it near a nuclear war right then.
Right.
And now we're really armed to the teeth, both sides.
It was, read a little bit about, the world is just so screwed up. Is it McCabe, that little Weasley Napoleon guy that came out of the FBI, some reason he got on 60 Minutes and said that Trump is all in bed with the Russians and that the cabinet of Trump's own cabinet thought about invoking the 25th Amendment to take him out of office, that he wasn't mentally capable of being president. And there was one guy wrote an article that as a constitutional expert, and said, what's amazing about this is that even if there were some agents from the FBI that thought that was a possibility, it's as if they've never read the U.S. Constitution. He went through the same. There isn't any chance, under any circumstances, that the majority of the cabinet that Trump appointed is going to turn against him, much less it doesn't start with the cabinet anyway. It'd have to start with Pence, the vice president. And he went through and said, what vice president do you think is going to take someone like Trump and say, he's not fit for office, I need to be president, and try to get the cabinet to go along with him? What do you think, how long do you think that Pence would live, as fanatical as Trump supporters are, if you were to pull off that? Mm-hmm. He knows that. And then, on top of that, you have to get 2/3 of the Senate and 2/3 of the Congress to support it. All Trump would have to do is go to the Congress, and if they couldn't pass a resolution with a two-thirds majority, he walks right back into the White House. And so this guy was saying, how in the world could 60 Minutes have be a journalistic show and not point out the impossibility of that, that it never happened? How could the FBI be a Federal Bureau of Investigation and they can't, they don't even bother to read the Constitution and know what they're saying is preposterous? So, yeah, we have really reached a period where there's nobody thinking on either side. Yeah. Beginning what I think would be the spring of 2027, there's going to be a tidal wave of terrorism. You know, far worse on Israel than the combined conquests of the Assyrians, Babylonians, Greeks, and Romans. It's going to be more pervasive and more vicious than the Holocaust. With these words, which follow, we're witnessing the prologue to World War. It begins with oy. Woe. Be wary of the preponderance of people of a great many nations. Rabim amim. A multitude of compatriots. An abundance of kinsmen related by race, religion, or culture. A large quantity of citizens and a great many individuals and countries, even numerous groups and obsessive followers, who will roar in hordes of agitated and confused terrorists. Hamon. And vast multitudes of bewildered and loud-mouthed militants, flaunting their abundant wealth while clamoring emotionally with their worldly possessions in massively disorderly riots, which are extensive and excessive. But the population agitated and enraged, boisterous, crying out in turmoil, the masses congregating along with their troops for military purposes, similar to loudly groaning and stormy and enraged seas, fused and chaotic, uproarious, intoxicated, snarling, wind-driven, surging seas, Yamin, which is synonymous with Gentiles. An uproarious, continually snarling and angry, electing to be driven by the winds of religious and political and social desire. They will shout out in agitated and anguished screams, snarling like confused and chaotic terrorists. Well, that's a pretty dire picture, isn't it?
Yeah, you're kidding.
Now, Kirk, you you typically look up the words. How did you see Rabim Amin?
I'm not there. I was trying to find what verse you were on. I'm sorry. Is that 17:12?
1712.
Okay, well, let me get this. I beg your pardon. Talk for a minute, and I'll find it real quick. I must have kept it somehow.
And then from there, you know, Hamon. Hamon's
a
really good
Hamon. No. Hamon was really good. That's Hamon from Hamah, and that's a murmur and a roar and roars of waves and cry out loud, to rush about madly, destructively, and greatly agitated from Haman, which is to move noisily, being confused, which you addressed in all of your translations. And then the root was interesting, too, because you have an H-M or a H-M, and which is looking towards water. But it also has a meaning of roar, which is roar, destroy, actionable words, roar and destruction. And the object of that root would be a sea or a multitude. And then abstractly, I guess you could say, a tumult or destruction represents a large body of water seen as a place of chaos because of its storms, its turbulence, surf and commotions of its waves. So it's a great metaphor for this act of these people as they...
One thing you find, like in the Song of the Sea, and also in the Mizmor, I think it's 83, 84, that you know, where Yahweh really does like horticultural metaphors, you know, of grains of, and of calf and of olives, for example. At this time, he is one of his favorite metaphors is the sea.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason he likes the sea, first, we've all seen it. But second, sea is synonymous with Gentiles. Because it's the Jews, the Yahudim, who are synonymous with the land. The land of Israel and the people that are Israelites are synonymous.
Yeah,
and so the land, right, is Israel, and the sea is those who are opposed to Israel, those who are distinct from Israel. And so, if you take that metaphor of the sea, and you realize that the sea can be a source of life, and not when it's stormy. You know, look at the tsunamis that rolled into Indonesia. Probably the most destructive force on Earth is a... Look at what had happened in the Japanese cities with that earthquake. The mud and the debris and the power of the water. It may be the most single destructive force on Earth. The stormy sea. And the stormy sea is... look at the, what happened in Florida and throughout the Caribbean these past couple of years with these hellacious pounding of the seas and the storm surges associated with those hurricanes. And so if you have the seas enraged and stormy and loud and snarling and flooding into the land and eroding it, it's a marvelous picture, a horrid picture, but it's a very effective picture of what is going to happen with these jihadists. And they're going to be loud, singing the praises of their wannabe God, shouting Allahu Akbar. Yeah. So, you know, God is telling us this is not going to be a quiet scene. And keep in mind, we are entering an entirely different era. And we may already be there, but it's an era where you've got, 7 billion smartphones on the planet. Camera ready, video ready. 7 billion of them. And the average person is spending almost 7 hours a day online. The preponderance of the sites they're going through are social media sites.
Mm-hmm.
And so when this flood of stormy and enraged Muslims begins to erode Israel, flooding in like a tsunami, everyone in the world is going to see it. Going to see it from a million different vantage points.
Yeah. Yeah.
All why it's happening with sound and video, audio and video. So these terms, I think, do a great job of explaining what's going to be seen by the whole world. Then it says, then the corrupting roar and the destructive societal chaos, Shaon, the loud mocking cry, as things crash down in ruins, and the huge, presumptuous crowds of rebellious, of confused, political and religious, brawling, militant terrorists who have all been panicked into fighting while wallowing in their own depressed slime pits of wasteful desolation. But the people of these nations who are transformed while massing under a single religious and political leader will be like the horrible, destructive, and desolating uproar of the flood. Forcefully and in great numbers, capitulating to the will of another, they will continually strive to destroy, moving rapidly while creating an uproar. the now first the, thing here that just struck. Go ahead, Kirk.
No, I was just going to ask the person that that y'all was talking about here. Is it the tallest one, or is he talking about because they follow Muhammad, and then the rest of them follow? So it's the religious.
Yeah, the term. You jumped ahead. Yeah, you jumped ahead to. You jumped. No, that's right. There are several words in this that are astonishing in their insights. And the first of them is Sha'on, and the second is Leon. I ended up probably translating another 50 pages of material just because of Leon. So Leon, to me, is an extremely important concept. But let's just start for a moment with Sha'on. Sha'on primarily conveys this idea of a corrupting roar of destructive societal chaos. And I think that's where we're headed as a world. You see so many people, particularly in the Islamic world, but even in America now, marching and chanting, and there's societal chaos. I think we're going to see a lot of riots. And they're loud. They're crying. They're mocking. Everything they touch is ruined. They're presumptuous. This idea that that they're somehow like the 1%, the 99%ers, and the 1%ers, and all their little slogans and their chants.
Mm-hmm.
The crowds are presumptuous. They're rebellious. They are really confused, and they are unbelievably political. And then, if you combine those with the militants, you're talking about jihadists who are wallowing in their. Just think of the country these jihadists came from. Oh, they're so impoverished, and the only thing they have that's any good is all because of the oil wealth that they confiscated.
Mm-hmm.
And yet. I was talking to somebody that knows Crown Prince Mohammed. Knew him as a young man. And was talking about how at 14 years old, he had already murdered two women. There were two. He was just so maniacal, so much of a psychopath without empathy. Just for fun, he tortured and killed two of his housekeepers at 14 years old. He ordered the murder and dismemberment of Khashoggi. That was culmination of a lifetime. Just who they are. The number of women who are sex slaves who were lured into Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. And these Islamic countries that can't leave, that have their passports taken, and that never even see the light of day. They don't even get out of the basements of these palaces where they're routinely tortured and abused. You could not. You cannot even fathom a more disgusting group of people and culture than what exists in these Islamic fiefdoms. So what this word suggests is that the people that are perpetrating this hell on the world, that are convinced that their way and their God and their religion are superior, come from the most disgusting slime pits of human decadence. Now, this is the place of Bachi Ba, of tying little boys to bed so they can be raped by the elders. It speaks of people who are rebellious, confused, political, religious, of terrorists, of people wallowing in their own depressed slime. But it's also a word that is directly related to Sha'ul, mm-hmm. the author of the Religion of Christianity, and Sheol, of imprisonment, incarceration, is from Sha'ah, which is to crash into lifeless ruins. So those that are coming in and representing all of this societal chaos, they are representing Sheol. And many of them will represent Sha'ul. And, you know, it's hard to fathom this first phase of the Magog War as anything other than Muslims, because it all talks about terrorist acts. And yet, you know, Roman Catholic Church is still promoting this myth of Jews as the killers of Jesus. Marsan, the president of France, came out yesterday in a speech and said that at no time, including the period immediately before and during World War II, has anti-Semitism been so great throughout France and throughout Europe. He says this is a time where Jewish boys and girls, which represent in France, it's got the third highest concentration of Jews anywhere in the world, so they can't even go to public schools.
Really?
We are really entering a period where the adversarial nature of Sheol and Sha'ul and the adversary Hasatan, for Yahweh's chosen, is going to become so extreme, you're going to see the ugly, riotous, confused face of Sheol reflected in the world citizens. And so there's going to be a lot of Sha'ul and those who go into Israel. But, you know, the Torahless one is going to unite Islam and Christianity. And the great Abrahamic religions are going to promote the fact that there is a Jesus in the Quran. And it's going to unite them. So then we come up with this very unusual term, Laom.
Mm-hmm.
So then this corrupting roar of destructive societal chaos comes from Laom. And so you look at Laom and say, well, why do you choose Laom? Normally you would use Goyim or Am, but Laom? You know, it's not just talking about individuals. That could be Ish, Enoch, talking about mortals.
Mm-hmm.
People of a different land would be Eretz, but this is Laom. And so I started studying what does Laom mean, and how does it differ from other words? And the first thing that you find is that Laom speaks of people from nations who are somehow transformed. They're changed. Someone or something causes the people to be different. Well, that could be speaking specifically of what the Torahless one's going to do to get people to align with him,
right?
Going to create a blended religion, going to create a world political mindset, going to create an even more militaristic mindset. And so it speaks of people being transformed, of a change in the nature of people. And it speaks of them massing, congregating under a singular religious and political leader. So it this context, it's pretty hard not to see the Torahless one of that individual.
You know, I found very similar. This is a short definition, but obviously it said people and nations, but it also said in the lexicons, it said obviously religious in this case, and then it went on to say that the plural is of Arabian communities. So, I mean, that's kind of right to the heart of it. Religion is a problem. You know, all through this, and I wrote you a little note, Will, up there, get to one day just to get your comments on it, or, you know, and JB, on everything is religious. God hates religions worse than, I can't think of anything that's number one. He just cannot stand it, and he uses these beautiful words that are so impacted with how much he, you know, he tells you exactly what the problem is. It's not because you ran around like David, or you did this, or you know, it's just religion is the killer of human souls.
It's the incurable disease.
Yep.
And that's the thing most precluded from being with God. So Laom is one word that in a future program we're going to spend a lot of time on Laom, because the context where it is used is one of those things that just profoundly changes, not doesn't change, it profoundly enhances our understanding of what God is supposed to and what man is going to promote in these last days. So, and then a corrupting roar of the destructive societal chaos of the people of these nations were transformed while massing under a single religious and political leader. It would be like the horrible and destructive, desolating uproar shown again of the flood. And you find this flood over and over and over again. Man, the surging sea. And the reason it's over and over again is that God must talk about this invasion of and destructive act against Israel in 50 different places.
Mm-hmm.
And all you have to do is take the unique words that are being used here, and you're like Laom, and you find so many insightful hints as to who the people are, what the timing is, how they're coming into Israel, what their intent is, the consequence of their invasion. But Sheol is one of those really telling terms. The world as a whole is going to represent Sheol. We're going to experience literally hell on earth. Forcefully and in great numbers, Kabir, in abundance and seeking fame and fortune. Wickedly and intensely intertwined, thought to be extraordinarily powerful and fortunate, with grating passion, capitulating to the will of another, they will continually strive to destroy, moving rapidly while creating an uproar. So Kabir is in great numbers. Now this is, the flood is a flood of militants. This is not water. It's a flood of militants in great numbers who are violent, seeking fame and fortune, as Muslims have always done. Capitulating to the will of another, it's interesting there. This was the Nifl Imperfect Paragogic, which says, habitually, the imperfect, these jihadists are destroyed as they lay waste, acquiescing to the will of the one driving them. I've got an amazing way this word is shaped here. In Sha'ah, they will always want to ruin everything they touch. Which is that, I've said so many times that Muslims aren't going to conquer the world, but they're going to go far and wide to destroy it. You know, when Muslims reached out of Saudi Arabia right after Muhammad's death and went into India and then throughout Persia and across northern Africa and into Europe, it really wasn't conquering. It was destroying. You know, raping the world. So they will want to ruin everything they touch, devastating themselves in the process, leaving lifelessness in their wake, while blaring as they rush along, such that it is prudent to watch them very closely and intensely for a duration of time. God said, pay attention. You should pay attention to what you're witnessing here.
Mm-hmm.
There's lessons to be learned. So this begins with oi. Anytime we see an oi,
pay attention. This is not good.
Yeah, pay attention. Yeah. Yeah, while henna is also used to gain our attention,
Mm-hmm. But this is...
Henna can be... Yeah, henna can be a good thing.
Yeah.
Pay attention to what I'm going to tell you here. I'm going to talk about the covenant.
Really good stuff, but this is really scary stuff. Don't go there. Or the house...
Yeah, don't go there. Rabin reveals that this will not be an isolated terrorist attack. This is not going to be a 9/11.
No.
The preponderance of the population of a great many nations. You know, it's hard not to see this as a lot more than just an Islamic invasion. And particularly when you take it out to the second phase of this.
Phase two, yeah.
Yeah, phase two is world war. So, this is either in many nations or the preponderance of nations. Any way you're looking at it, this is a flood of humans. And they are Hamon. You know, Hamon is one of those terms that caused me initially to see Islam in all of this, because Hamon conveys terror. You know, Hamon speaks of people who are agitated and angry. Boy, look at the faces of the Muslim jihadists. They're agitated, they're angry, they're obviously confused by their religion, they're bewildered by what they experience. Now, the militants are going to be loudmouthed, they're emotionally clamoring, Allahu Akbar, Allah's a mouse. Hordes of murderous men. Literally embody riotous behavior.
Yeah.
That is where we're headed. Now, it's also interesting that Haman was used in conjunction with Gog. And Yachigel, if God grows, Ezekiel 39:11, to describe how the preponderance of the population will be in a confused uproar, exciting riots at a time the fate of Yisrael is in peril. Now, that's meaningful because this creates another tie between the events that are being foretold here in Yashayah and the Magog War.
Yeah,
right.
Absolutely.
And the Magog War is, you know, begins as an all-Islamic attack on Israel, not where it ends. So,
well,
yeah.
Third of the world and then 25% of that. Yeah.
Right. So, yeah, we're
down about 3.5 billion people. Yeah, we'd be down less to probably around 3 billion people, or a little bit more.
I think so. Yeah. Yeah. You know, I think that what is it that in the first phase it's one out of four, and the second phase, and then a third of those.
A third of the balance. Yeah. So net. Yeah.
Mhm.
And so we've got to wipe out half of the world.
Half the world's going to be gone. That ha-hama, they will be loud and destructive, stormy, surging, like you mean, a sea of Gentiles. The scene will be confused and chaotic, which suggests militants rather than militaries. You know, militaries are usually not chaotic.
No, but a Muslim wouldn't be. These are not trained to systematically attack something and designate targets. They just go in and just wipe everything out. That's the ammo.
Yeah, you know what?
No, that's the way it's always been.
It was really interesting. I was reading, translating yesterday. I'd seen it. You know, it talks about this fleet of battle groups that has been launched from a nation on the other side of the world, from Israel. And is trying to explain, using the words of his time,
mm-hmm.
what he's witnessing. I mean, he talks about these buzzing wings, these mechanical warbirds that hover over Israel, and he's then describing the ships themselves. And one of the things he says about the ships themselves is they're filled with people who are, in all essence, slaves. who don't even see the outside of these ships and who serve in them as if they were prisoners. And we're talking about, you know, the difference between Islamic militias and trained armies in terms of chaos. So, Yahshua is getting this glimpse of the future, and he's saying, the men and women, but particularly the men, within these warships have no say. They're in essence, slaves. And you think about how the U.S. Navy works on these ships and the fact that the enlisted had never seen the light of day. They don't get on the outside. And while they're there, they are essentially slaves.
Well, captain of the ship is the Lord Master, no question.
Yeah.
Try to do something, try to disagree with him.
Oh, my. But yeah, each word just goes on and on about how you're painting a picture of America. And then you come up with the layout. The population of these nations, this politically and religious organized massing of people under a unified government leader or a religious leader, is somehow transformed. And they will be as Ka, Shaom, horribly destructive and desolating, as floodwaters. You know, that's to say that this human opposition to God's chosen people in the land will be as unstoppable as a tsunami. And there's even more. I mean, Shaon, then we've even talked about thus far, it represents the corrupting and confusing nature of religion. It addresses its horrible propensity to rob souls of life. It espouses the religious nature of Shaul, the father of the Christian religion. And it depicts these militants as if they are stuck in the pit of Sheol. Literally telling us that we're going to witness hell. We're going to witness hell on earth. Yeah. This is the time of Jacob's troubles. It's as bad as the earth has ever experienced. Now, one of the things I find is interesting is that Shaon actually depicts the lightless prison known as a black hole. It describes a dark hole or black depression, which is massive and traps every object entering it. Shaon is black hole from the scientific description. A black hole, a dark and massive depression, which traps every object entering it. The own suffix following Sha suggests a binding association with Shaul and with Sheol, with religion and politics, with destruction and death, with confusing corruption.
Anything else is described that way. I mean, if it was quicksand, you wouldn't describe it that way. It may be something that drags you down and kills you, but not a black. I mean, that's really, I've been thinking about this. What better description? Where do you get a description like that that's not a black hole?
Yeah, it's so interesting.
What else would you use it for?
That Shaon and Sheol share the same
connection,
root.
Too, of course, yeah.
Right, and that the technical depiction of Shaon is black hole. And it's not just black hole and the name that the science has given these lightless places. It actually says that it's a lightless place that traps everything entering it. So it's the definition of a black hole and the name black hole, and both of those things are associated with what we've come to realize is the nature of Sheol. That Sheol is a black hole. It's a place where there is no light. It's where everything is trapped, where that which goes in never comes out. It's a place away from Yahweh's light, where the souls who have chosen to ally themselves with Halel bin Shakar, with the adversary. But who would have thought you'd have a word that would convey all of that and that it would be used at a time where human behavior on earth, particularly as it relates to Yahweh's chosen people
mm-hmm.
and land, is in fact reflecting the very conditions that we would expect in Sheol.
That's amazing.
It's just amazing to me. It's a tremendous insight that we get from it. You know, it's one of those moments where my mind raced, your heart soars, skin tingles. Yeah, Sha'on lays it all out for us. Man naked and exposed for
no place to
all
hide.
To consider. So that's one of the most breathtaking experiences I've had in translating is seeing all that come together and realize that this is the reason Yahweh has to cleanse the earth of religion and politics and militarism is because left to his own devices, now with this, you know, the restrainer pulled away, the set apart spirit in Yahweh's covenant children gone. That, and with Hasatan more active than any other time in history, and man with the technology to be so destructive, we are seeing Sheol on earth.
Mm-hmm.
And so it has to be cleansed for there to be a return to Eden. And so we're seeing the very dichotomy here. The Yahweh's vantage point, his desire to have a relationship with his children and a place of great joy, Eden, where there's no politics, no religion, no justice system, no militaries, no patriotism, none of that stuff. No men killing men. No women abusing women or men. We're looking at a perfect place to have a relationship with Yah on one side and religious and political man on the other. Sheol. It is really.
Yeah.
Yes. It's such a clear contrast. And then it all makes sense as to why everything has to come to a head at this time.
See if you get on Shah, you know, it's destructive and crashing and breaking violently and all those things. I found three little things, and one of them just says crash into ruins. I'm assuming they're talking cities because
yes.
That would be appropriate to this context. And then, obviously, it says later to lay waste and desolate like they did for the city.
Mm-hmm.
Then there was a third one, and it said to make a den. And I said, well, what does that relate to? And I thought, well, you know, wolves have dens, and this is all about Paul
mm-hmm.
or all about religious leaders. I mean, is that too big of a stretch? I mean, it's just
yeah.
right out of the old hexagon. So, I mean, it's Paul being the wolf. Leads them
yes.
down to destruction. So,
yeah, that's one of the things I thought was just so fascinating the other day. I was thinking about how it was the Benjamite wolf that
mm-hmm.
tackled Romans into becoming
okay.
Christians. But
really,
how was Rome? Yeah, what's the myth of Rome
yeah,
itself?
Romulus
and Remus. Yeah, yeah. Them being suckled.
Yeah.
By a wolf.
Well, that's what they were. That's really
yeah.
so good. It's just I don't think I've seen a stretch of verses that had so many terribly interesting words as this bunch.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm really
yeah.
In awe of Yahweh's choices. I mean, this is to come up with the words that mean that and then to be able to.
That's one of the reasons I came to the conclusion that the hardest thing to translate by far and the most interesting thing to translate by far are the same thing. And that's the prophetic text of Isaiah. His vocabulary is unlike anyone else's. In fact, when we get to the 18th chapter, Mm-hmm. Almost every word there is unique. And you really have to work at it to come up with the meaning of each word. They're only used enough that you can trace down their meaning by looking at the few other times that they're used. But they're, he's been taken to a view of the future, and he's trying his level best to come up with words to describe, well, what is it like to see this sea of drones and this sea of attack helicopters flying off of these extraordinarily fast fleets of naval ships, and all of this being promoted by, and then he describes the nature of the people, and he's like, and these are words that appear nowhere else, or very few other places,
mm-hmm.
and so you can't translate Yashaya quickly, because it's not like you're not just looking at the normal words and say, okay, you know, here's five sentences. They use 50 words, and all 50 words I've seen 1,000 times.
100 times.
You know, you just read it, and you write down the translation. But in this case, you've really got to do your homework, and you got to make certain that you're looking at every possible nuance in the meaning, and so don't get the least bit lazy, because there's so much more you learn if you just take the time. So it's the most rewarding, by far the most rewarding, and by far the most difficult.
Yeah, I'm sort of beginning.
I'm the exact opposite today. I was translating a passage from Ezekiel, and it was literally like the words used, it's not necessarily that they're completely common, but there's not a lot of nuance to the words. I mean, so like,
right.
I have very little of the parentheticals. I mean, most of it, you know, you're pretty much able to straightforward translate this almost word for word. But what I like about that is because of the nature of the passage, it's condemning the leader of Tyre. There's no wiggle room. I mean, it's outright condemning. I mean, it is blunt, straightforward, and to the point.
Yes. Just like...
What I did love, though, is there was a very nice, sarcastic line in there where Yahweh tells him, like, "You are wiser than David. Not all that is secret is known to you." Like, yeah, Yahweh's being sarcastic. I'm a bit of a sarcastic guy myself. I like that.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah. Okay. David just happened to be, the wisest person who ever lived. And so you think you're smarter than he is. Good luck with that.
Very rich.
But it doesn't even say you think. He just says you are. That's like, but you can tell it's definitely in this like sarcastic, so you're smarter than him. Okay.
Okay, yeah. All right, we'll go with that. Good luck with that.
Have it.
Yeah.
I was laughing the whole time I was translating that passage. But I translated 12 verses of the passage. I did the whole thing in about 3 hours. And usually something like that takes me 2 or 3 days.
Yeah.
Several hours each day.
Yeah.
This is
the easiest
passage I've ever translated.
Well, so we're in exactly the opposite, because then Yashaya 18, I'm finding myself spending a day on a word.
That was the last passage I was on with Yashaya, and yeah, it was that way where I was going and looking up this, and the nuances of the different, way the words used, and all the grammar is important. But this passage breezed through it.
So I have a question to either of you guys. Check it all on the claim that I made that there was no such place as Nazareth. That there could not have been a Jesus of Nazareth, even if they got his name right. That he was Yahusha, the Nazar, the branch.
I did not, but
I had zero free time.
Yeah. Yeah, I would encourage you guys, take a moment.
I will.
Because it changes so many things. That there is no Jesus of Nazareth. There was no Nazareth. But he, in fact, is introduced by his most important title, Branch. And so his introduction is, he is Yahusha, the Branch. By the way, who was Dode's most beloved friend?
Nathan? And early?
Jonathan, right? Jonathan.
Jonathan, I mean.
Saul's, yeah, Saul's son. Who was Yosha's most beloved disciple?
John.
Yeah. You know, when it talks about the prophetic nature of that the king, the future king of Israel is going to come from Bethlehem.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you think Dode was born?
Same place.
Yeah.
Bethlehem.
Yeah, I have looked that up, yeah.
Well,
pretty. That was good.
He is really good. He is. Because you look at it and you know that somebody would say, how can you say that Yosha is not going to have a kingdom just because Yahweh says that he is, you know, Yahweh is emphatic. He says that the millennial kingdom is going to be the kingdom of Dode. And he said, well, you know, this prophecy says that, you know, the one who was born in Bethlehem is going to be the king.
But then you find the
okay. Yeah. Well, look it up.
It's Yahusha of Nazareth, so it would be Yahusha of the branch. He was off the branch of Dode.
Mm-hmm. He's off the branch of Dode. The branch of Dode. And that is really important. That does not diminish Yahusha's importance or relevance. It increases him. Because the branch of Dode is the realization that the Torah can be understood and that it saves. That the Torah is our ticket to heaven. That Yahweh can be understood if we just take the time to think. And so being off of that branch, it's tremendous
credibility.
It's a good place to be. Yeah, I want to be on that same branch. So it is marvelous.
So this place...
Okay,
this
thank
place
you.
That, one quick question before you go. This place that they call it Nazareth on the Mount, what is that, where did that come from?
It was named Nazareth by Constantine's mommy.
Oh, Constantine's mama.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, she's the one that came up with the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. She's the one that came up with that the stupid mound out there in the middle of the Sinai as Mount Sinai for, you know, all that stuff. She was wrong about everything.
Yeah.
But the best guess is, yeah, there's actually a couple of books written on the fact that there was no Nazareth. And, you know, I'm spending more and more time trying to understand the Israelite viewpoint as to why they are so just irritated by the whole myth of Jesus Christ. You know, in fact, one of their curse words in Judaism is Christ on a stick. So I wasn't the first one to come up with dead God on a stick. Christ on a stick is a Yehudim phase. But they just mocked this whole thing of Nazareth. They know there was no Nazareth. You know, Nazareth didn't exist until it was retroactively, because there's nobody in Christendom that wants Yosha to be, or Jesus to be, the branch. They wanted to be the Messiah. Mm-hmm. But yet there's no indication that he was ever anointed.
Yeah.
And so, but there is one that shows him, well, the prophecy is that he would be a branch.
Mm-hmm.
And the branch is our life. It's a good thing.
Why don't they stand up and say that? Why are there not Yehudim who say, look, this is BS?
Yeah, and by the way, JB, when you were doing your translation, why didn't it say, so you think you're as smart as Yosha?
Yeah.
Okay. Clearly, Yosha, once the set apart spirit came upon Yosha, Yosha was smarter than Dode.
We're not diminishing Yosha.
But Yosha being brilliant isn't really relevant to us. because we're not God. We're not a diminished manifestation of God. Dode was a human. He's relevant to us. His intellect is relevant to us. Yosha's is not relevant to us. Yosha's wisdom is all conveyed in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. It's all available to us.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it's explained in the writings of Dode, but Yosha himself doesn't have any writing. So it is definitely fun to study. Oh, time for me to go and take my dog out before she crashes for the evening. And now I have a 4-month-old Labrador puppy who's been on the airplane for 3 hours from Florida to Indiana. Had a marvelous time with us in Indiana, and then 30 minutes from Indiana to here in Ohio. And has decided she's going to listen to the show every time I do it now, the show. She is my number one new fan. I now have she sometimes sleeps on the job. But even if she sleeps on the job, she's right there on top of my feet. So she's cute about it.
That's my dog every week, sitting underneath the desk, laying on my feet.
Yeah. I know.
Looking up at me going, when are you going to pet me?
When are you going to pet me? Yeah, when are you going to pet me? They're so adorable and so loving and so fun.
Mm-hmm.
All right, fellas. Mm-hmm. Well, this time next week, thank you for getting the switchboard open.
No problem.
Timing was perfect.
I may not be here next week. I got family coming into town, and depending on when they arrive, I may not be able to join you guys. They're going to be staying with us, so we'll have a house full.
Yeah.
Okay. I understand.
But we'll see. If I can make it, I'll be here.
All right.
Okay.
Good deal.
That's terrific. Have you heard anything about your job?
No, not at all.
Okay. And you're not expecting to hear anything for a while anyway, so no big deal.
Yeah. Okay. I'm not giving my hopes up either, so.
Okay. Yeah. All right, gentlemen.
I'm hopeful for you, but we'll cross that bridge later. Yes. Shabbat shalom. Good night.
Good night. Good night. Good night.